Omea Coalition will stand with Omea on Friday, December 16th, 9 a.m. in Philadelphia at the Court of Common Pleas. If you would like to join us on our chartered bus to Philadelphia to demand a new trial for Omea, go to bringmomeahome.com. That's bringmomeahome.com to reserve a seat or call 212-330-8029. That's 212-330-8029 for further details.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. It is 5 p.m.
Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. As long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone.
A whole lot of police cars. Leon Thomas there on vocals. Johnny Hodges, alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. Before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins. I've taken that fine movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Last week, we had a wonderful event at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism, where I teach. The event was called Why Clemency Matters When Mercy Tempers Justice. We heard from several speakers, some of them who had received clemency from New York's governor in the past few years, and we also heard from the former superintendent of a maximum security women's prison who talked about how clemency, granting someone who is serving a lengthy sentence remittance from that long term and setting them free or giving them the grounds to go before a parole board, how that clemency raises the spirits of everybody on both sides of the bars, guards, other inmates, everybody involved in the prison. The event was aimed at pressing the argument that clemency, which is the governor's unchallenged right to lessen anyone's prison term, that it benefits everyone on society and inside prison. At the event were 10 people who have won clemency since 2016. Taken together, they had served some 285 years in prison, by my calculation. All of them had been serving terms that had life on the end, which means that if not for having received clemency, most of them might well have died behind bars. Although clemency is that awesome tool that governors can employ at their will, it's sadly rarely used. Cuomo, on his way out, Andrew Cuomo, did a handful of them in 2021. And those people who made it home, though, made it home not just because of the governor's decision, but because they refused to give up despite receiving sentences that effectively said society had no more use for them. And this particular group, that we heard from at the event at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism made it home with the help of an extraordinary program that's at the City University School of Law, which runs a defender's clinic that is specialized in providing legal representation and advocacy for people serving long terms in prison. One of the people who came home and who spoke at the event was a remarkable man named Greg Mingo. Mr. Mingo served 40 years in New York State prisons for a crime he did not commit. Last year, he was granted clemency by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was on the way out the door after resigning. Since his release, Mr. Mingo has been talking about his long, hard journey. He spent a part of today, I think, maybe he'll talk about this, talking to high school students. Mr. Mingo's a tall man with a remarkably calm and self-assured demeanor, especially for a guy who spent four decades locked up for something he didn't do. And I wanted to have him on this show to tell people about his life, his struggles, and the lessons learned along the way. Welcome, Greg Mingo, to WBAI. It's an honor to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You know, in your talk, Greg Mingo, last week at our event, you mentioned a friend of yours who had arrived at prison at the age of 16 and who died just before your release last fall. You had 10 more years to serve if you'd not been granted clemency. There was no guarantee that you would have been released even when you became eligible for parole. Did you think that you would survive prison?
Well, it was days that I really questioned whether or not I would ever be released. I was faced with a number of obstacles that I convicted, and I don't like to point the finger at anybody, but due to my counsel's ineffectiveness, both at trial and on an appeal, I was procedurally barred from having all of my claims heard by the courts. I was literally in no man's land, and that became my worst nightmare. And so through then, I just kept fighting and pushing and, trying to find a way to get back home. But there was many a nights in there where I didn't think I would make it back home.
As well you might. Can you tell us a little bit about who you were at the time of your conviction?
At the time of my conviction, I was 28 years old. I had a job. I had worked with New Human Services Institute. That is doing paraprofessional work. And, I just had a normal life just like anybody else. Then I went to bed, and the next day I woke up, and my worst nightmare came true. I was arrested. I was tried twice for the same crime. First trial ended in a mistrial. The second trial, I was convicted, and I thought I was facing a maximum of 25 years to life. Little did I know that the law allowed them to sentence me to consecutive sentences, and I received a 50 to life year sentence. And I completed 80% of that sentence before I received clemency.
Yeah, you definitely paid your dues, and that you didn't even owe. Your prison term came. You were convicted of taking part in the murder of two people who died during a robbery. You had a pretty good alibi for where you were, didn't you?
Yes, I was out of state at the time. The alibi evidence wasn't presented, and because of it, I was subsequently convicted. And I spent decades trying to clear my name, trying to free myself. And I'm not, my situation is not unique. There's many others like me inside. You see it all the time on the news, Central Park Five, the people who were charged and convicted of killing Malcolm X. You see it across the country. So it's not unique just specifically to New York. It's a broad spectrum of wrongful convictions, and they're caught more often than not. And unless you really experienced it and had to live through it, You really don't have an idea how taxing it can be physically, emotionally, and mentally.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. You know, I think that there's a truism that, people repeat with kind of a cynical cackle where they say, oh, yeah, everybody in prison is innocent of the crime that they were convicted of. But if you had to estimate, Greg Mingo, the number of folks you ran into while you were inside, I mean, what do you think the percentage is of people who either are, absolutely innocent of the crime they were convicted of or who were just convicted of a crime which they may have been part of, but which they didn't actually commit?
Oh, I would have to say, if I had to give an estimate in terms of numbers, I would say maybe 30 to 40%.
Really?
Because you have to remember, a lot of times, just say, for instance, somebody got in trouble before, right? And they made a bad choice, a bad decision, and they got in trouble before. If ever they ever went through the criminal justice system itself, went to trial, they know what to expect next time around. So just say that person gets arrested and charged with a crime. Most convictions end in pleas.
Right.
Because the idea of going to trial is not a pleasant one. Because if you go to trial and you exercise your right to a jury trial, you get punished for wasting their time. That's how they view it. You take this plea, and if you don't take the plea, we take you to trial. If you go to trial, we're going to give you the max. And that's what they do in essentially most cases. It's even gotten to the point where now felony murder, which is a murder committed during the course of a felony. So say somebody's robbing somebody or committing a burglary and somebody dies as a result, you're charged with felony murder. There's no intent to commit the felony, but nevertheless, somebody unfortunately loses their life. Now they've upgraded that to include that in the first-degree murder statute, meaning now the court can sentence you to life without the possibility of parole. So you have so many variables and so many factors working against you, it's hard to navigate. So a lot of people just cop out because they don't want to run the risk of going to trial and getting a life sentence.
Were you offered a plea, Greg Mingo?
Yes, I was. I was offered a plea before the first trial. Turned it down. Before the retrial, I was offered another plea. I turned it down. And I wasn't willing to compromise my principles because I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. And so I went to trial, you know, and I rolled the dice, so to speak, and I got convicted. And I wound up losing 40 years of my life because of it.
And the judge who exercised his discretion to give you, which is really, it's called double life, right? Those consecutive 25 to life sentences, meaning a minimum of 50 years that you'd have to do. This is a judge who later was sanctioned for, using the N-word while he was on the bench, right?
Right, yeah. That was just one of the instances. He was later sanctioned. Judges have to retire at the age of 70, but they allowed 3 2-year extensions. He was on his last level, his last extension. So he used the N-word in open court. And when he was brought before the Commission on Judicial Conduct, his defense was that it didn't refer to any person or group of people and that it was a metaphor he used to describe a mystery. Mm. That was his defense. Mm. It sounds kind of off the wall, but that was his defense. So basically, they just censured him, which amounted to a slap on the wrist, and he went on about his, the rest of his life. He also has, Jimmy Breslin also wrote an article years ago about this particular judge where he presided over a rape case, and he made a derogatory comment to the effect that, oh, this the part, oh, when the jury asked for testimony of the actual attack read back, his statement was, oh, this the part, old men love to hear, and the victim ran out the courtroom crying.
Wow.
Another incident where a woman had killed her batterer, a husband who had been constantly abusing her, and he made a comment that maybe she needed to be disciplined. So this was the kind of person that was sitting on the bench presiding over cases.
And the guy who decided your life by saying that you should go to jail for no less than 50 years. Well, it's pretty stunning, just the circumstances on all sides. Your lawyer didn't even present any witnesses that could have helped establish your innocence, right, which must have made you pretty crazy while you were sitting there and realizing you were getting convicted on something you didn't do.
Yeah, and the thing is this, when you're in that situation, everything is placed in your attorney's hand. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of great attorneys out there, but just like anywhere else, good and bad people in every field, in the police department, corrections, even in prison, there's good and bad people. So, you know, when you get in that kind of situation and you have someone who doesn't have any vested interest in your outcome, a lot of times they really don't care. You know, blaming a lawyer is easy. You know, finger pointing and placing blame is always easy. But it's more often true than not.
Right.
And the sad part is that Judith Kaye issued some years ago, formed a commission. And the commission determined that criminal defendants in New York State receive ineffective assistance of counsel for the most part, in large part.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, mm-hmm, routinely, courts deny applications based on ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right. They're the hardest appeals to win, I think. Judith Kaye, right, the former chief judge of New York State, who knew whereof she spoke. Folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, and I'm talking to Greg Mingo, who was released last year after serving 4 decades in New York State prisons for a crime he did not commit. In prison, though, Mr. Mingo, you hit the ground running, didn't you? You became pretty expert at the law yourself. You worked in the law library. That must have taken a bit of gumption.
Yeah. Well, I had very little options at that point. The day out after I got arrested, started going to the prison law library and started studying and learning and, you know, to some advice and from other people that I could go to talk about the law. And I was filing motions in court for my trial. In fact, the judge got upset because I was filing motions, motion to act as co-counsel, motions for bail. And you know, I became pretty good at it. So when I eventually was convicted, came upstate, and I took every kind of legal course you could imagine. I studied 21 areas of law. I even took it. The course is over again a second time just to make sure I had it down pat. And then I worked in prison law libraries. I've helped people get home, helped get their sentence reduced. But I wasn't able to help myself because of the procedural bar. And in addition, I spent a lot of my time counseling. I taught, facilitated and taught classes. I taught the legal class in prison. Guys could learn how to become law clerks and work in the law library. I taught domestic violence, communications, fatherhood, positive thinking. You name it, I was involved in it.
Tell us a little bit about those courses in law that you took. Were these courses by subscription? Were there volunteers who were coming in to teach? How did you take these courses?
Well, initially, when I first came upstate, they had a program where it was a paralegal program, and prisoners' staff all attended the class. It could be a civilian, a staff member, it could be a correction officer, and it could be a prisoner, all in the same classroom. And we had outside professors coming in and teaching the classes. This was the first of its kind, and I've never seen anything like it since. And the course was 5 nights a week for 6 months. And so I took it twice just to make sure I had it. And then it's a matter of trial and error, practicing, reading, understanding how to interpret the law, how to write legal arguments. So I just became very good at it. And that was my area to work at, was the law library. And
this
more
is in
importantly,
the
I needed it for myself.
This is in the mid-1980s. This is before the crackdown came on college and prison when New York's governor and President Clinton together ended funding for college classes in prison. But what facility were you in where you were able to take this law class?
It was in Sing Sing Correctional Facility.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I've never seen a course of this kind afterwards. Right now, if anybody wants to take a legal course, you have to take essentially the course that I taught. I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I developed a curriculum for the legal research class, and I use that to teach the guys inside about the law so that they could become law clerks. When I teach the class, it was 18 weeks. It was twice a week. And then after the course, Albany would issue them a test and proctor the exams. And then if they passed it, they was eligible to work in the law library throughout New York State. And the course was a good course because you had, I'm trying to remember the name of the course, but you had other courses that you could take outside. There's one in particular, where you could take the course, but if you took that course and got a certificate from it, Department of Corrections didn't even acknowledge that course as being a legitimate means for you to be a law clerk. So the only one that was available to everybody was the one that was taught inside.
Well, I guess there's a certain amount of kind of serendipity involved that you managed to be in Sing Sing at the time that those courses were available and to launch you on what became a pretty effective course yourself in teaching the law. But you bounced around. You were telling me yesterday around a lot of the state's maximum security prisons during your time inside, and you told me it was because you were a guy who raised questions. what kind of questions were you raising, Greg Mingo, that led you to be sent from one facility to another?
Things happen inside all the time, policies and practices. And in Sing Sing, I was there, and there was something that just didn't sit right with me, so I challenged it. And I contended that the superintendent and the program coordinator was using a selective, intentional, discriminatory practices and implementing double standard policies in terms of how they treated people based on race. Well, that didn't sit too well with them. And so I was subsequently transferred and put on a wheel, if that's what they call it, where I was sent to one prison for a couple of weeks, locked in a cell with access to nothing, no shower, no change of clothes, anything, then transferred to another prison and went through that again. So literally for a whole month, I showered in my sink and washed my clothes in my sink. And you never left the cell.
And that's because every time you were brought to a new prison, they quarantined you for the first couple of weeks, right?
Right. Well, usually quarantine is only a couple of days. But once they put you on the wheel, you're quarantined for as long as they want you to be quarantined. So in other words, it's a way for them to retaliate against you without actually doing something to you.
I see. So they actually were putting the finger on you because they were trying to teach you a lesson to just be quiet.
Right, exactly.
Right. Did they succeed?
No. Because I've had it happen a number of times. I left Sing Sing. And after I left Sing Sing, I was transferred to Attica. I went to Easton. And I ran into a similar situation in Easton. And I was transferred back to Attica, and I challenged it again, and I won again. And then it happened again when I was in Elmira. And I was transferred to Comstock. And then when I got to Comstock, they refused to allow me to work in the law library. I had to go to court and fight them for 2 years just to work in the law library. So, you know, it was always... I'm a firm believer. I believe I don't like injustice of any kind. And so when I see it, you know that old expression they have now on the subway stations, if you see something, say something. Well, when I saw injustice inside, I said something.
Right.
And that didn't sit too well with a lot of people.
Good for you.
And so there's a price to be paid.
You know, you just ran off a string of names of some of the really the most notorious prisons in New York, Attica, Elmira. To most people who haven't spent time inside, they're just names. Are there significant differences for you as you travel from one to the other in terms of conditions and the way you're treated?
Oh, yes, definitely. And for instance, in a place like Sing Sing, it tends to be a little, you have a little more opportunities. And the further up north you go, the less opportunities you have, the worse treatment you're going to face. For instance, places like Attica, Clinton, Comstock, you get treated like less than human. Mm. The treatment is bad overall, but for those facilities that are further up north, it's like night and day. And don't get me wrong, I'm not putting everybody in one cesspool the way prisoners are put in the cesspool. I understand that everybody, there's good people and bad people, and sometimes you just can't separate the two.
Right.
And even they experience peer pressure inside from their fellow officers. During my time inside, I found one officer that stood up and did the right thing, and he paid a price for it.
What do you mean?
Threatened. I mean, he was threatened. They would call him up and threaten him. They're going to get him in the parking lot. And, you know, it came to a point where, and this was in Green Haven, it came to a point where everybody was called a roll call, and they was issued that if anything happened to this officer, a price had to be paid for everybody.
Can you tell us anything about the specifics of what was involved in that incident?
Well, the instance where somebody, there was a confrontation, and the officers tried to say that somebody in particular assaulted them, and that's why they beat them up. And that's how, that was their narrative. The reality was that the guy hadn't been confrontational at all. And they just had it, saw an opportunity to jump on him and beat him up, and they did it.
Mm.
This one officer didn't go along with the plan. He stood up and spoke out and said what really happened. And because of that, you know, they came after him.
Hmm. Well, that's always the predicament, right, is that even an officer who wants to play by the rules is often dragged along by those who play outside the lines, as in this case these other guys were doing.
Yeah, it's the same thing everywhere. You see it in the NYPD. You see it even in jobs situations. Everybody wants you to fall in line and go along with what everybody else is doing, even if it's wrong.
Did you spend time in solitary, Greg Mingo, during the time that you were incarcerated?
Yes, I did. I think if you spend any amount of time in prison, any lengthy amount of time in prison, you're going to spend time in solitary.
And
so I spent time in there, yes.
You know,
and
go ahead.
And no, I was going to say, and in solitary, you basically relegated to, you don't have your personal property. So you're in the cell, you're allowed to come out 1 hour a day, where they take you out of one cell and put you in a cage. And that's where you spend your recreation, in a cage by yourself. And, you know, there's really nothing to do. You just stuck in there, so you have to find something to do, something to help you keep your sanity. You got to remember, prison is basically a human warehouse for people who are considered misfits and outcasts. You know, everything we've taken for granted is gone. We have no control over our lives. Faithless people decide when and where we eat, sleep, work, and wake up. You know, our lives are fastened to a set of rules and regulations, and all they do is discourage individuality, and there's no privacy. It's non-existent. It's an emotional zoo. You know, prison is time. It's not just doing the physical time, but it's the emotional and the mental survival.
And solitary is the most extreme part of that, right? I mean, did you find that your own mental health was in jeopardy from spending time inside the hole?
Somewhat. You know, you have the fear and self-pity that comes and goes. Certain New Year's situation, you know, you try to remain cautious, alert, ready for whatever. Whatever desperation you feel, you hide it, learn to cry in silence. And as the hours go by, you know, it frustrates your thoughts of tomorrow. and you suddenly realize the true meaning of helplessness. You know, it's almost as if the four walls of fear, doubt, and loneliness, you know, plant themselves deeply within you, you know, and cause you to question the existence of life.
That's a devastating description. We're going to pause right there for this moment to play a tune that I played the same tune a few weeks ago when we had a filmmaker named Yoruba Richin on, and it's by Abby Lincoln. It's called A Caged Bird. Reggie Johnson, we got this tune?
With ruffled feathers on tiny swings and speculate birdseed and while away the day and tuck their heads in bed.
Abby Lincoln, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I don't know why I found that song appropriate, Greg Mingo, but I was thinking about it when I was thinking about your case and the time you spent inside. You know, we were talking before about your claim of innocence. Was that something that you kept to yourself inside, or could you talk about it with other people who were incarcerated with you?
I mean, you talk about it. I worked in a law library, so... we were talking about it amongst ourselves, basically. Because, you know, like you said, everybody is this old thing that everybody in prison is innocent.
Right.
So you basically keep it to yourself, and it doesn't really matter. You could claim you're innocent. People claim they're innocent and they're guilty as hell.
Right.
But, you know, so you just basically keep it to yourself, and you just keep doing what you do, and you keep fighting to clear your name. And that's all you can do.
I read, you know, there's a reporter at WNYC, Arun Venugopal, who's written and recorded some great stories about your case, that your sister moved to Ossining when you were at Sing Sing to be closer to you when you were located there. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. They lived in the Bronx, so they moved up to Ossining. This is when I was in Sing Sing, so it would make visitation a lot easier. And then they started building their home here, and I was transferred. I never made it back. I was never transferred back to Sing Sing. So they wound up raising their family up there in Ossining.
But that's a pretty wonderful statement, that a member of your family would literally relocate to try to be closer to her brother who was locked up. You know, a pretty wonderful sister.
Yeah.
And your niece as well, who was one of the people who, I think, started the petition for you. Am I right?
Right, yeah. My niece, who was born after I was incarcerated, her and a friend started a change.org petition. And, you know, just a group of young people just decided they want to do, try to find a way to help me. And most of them didn't know the story about me because I was kind of like, you know, my niece didn't have friends who had relatives who were in prison. So it wasn't something that people went around and talked about.
She was at Harvard at one point, right?
Yeah, she graduated from Harvard, and she went on to become a PA because medical school became too expensive, so she decided on a career as a PA.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to her friends and asked them would they write letters on my behalf. And so amongst themselves, they decided they wanted to do more. They started a change.org petition, and through that petition, got a lot of attention, and it started growing. And the change.org company itself got involved. And at the end, we had almost 145,000 people sign on the petition. I had a number of well-known people supported me and backed me. Celebrities, if you will. And they made a TV commercial. They made a billboard ad. And, you know, it was just an incredible amount of support.
It really took off, didn't
imagine.
It?
Huh?
It really took off, didn't it? Billboard truck, but I saw a billboard truck that was parked outside of the Albany legislature with said Free Greg Mingo.
Yeah, that's what they did. They parked it outside the Albany legislative office. They parked it outside the governor's office downtown. And then one day I woke up and somebody told me I was on TV, and I see this TV commercial that my niece and my sister made about me.
Hmm.
And, you know, got a lot of attention. Then I had some couple of people that one gentleman is a friend of mine made a movie. He was being interviewed for about Oscar contention, and he wore the Free Greg Mingo T-shirt. And it was just a lot of efforts on a lot of people to help get me home.
I should probably mention to folks that our event last week on Wednesday night at the City University of New York Newmark Graduate School of Journalism, when right after you spoke, I think, we aired a one-minute video from one of your fans, a woman named Amy Schumer, talked about how much she loved Greg Mingo, but also sort of wishing that there would be more efforts to bring folks like you home.
Mm. Yeah, Amy's an incredible, incredible person. She also helped in, you know, with her position and her platform to help get me home. I hadn't had an opportunity to meet her in person. So last Christmas when I was home, I made a video and had it sent to her through a friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And then on my one-year anniversary home, she invited us to Madison Square Garden. And we went backstage and hung out with her, took some pictures. They comped us tickets up front. And, you know, it was just a beautiful experience, you know, just to have somebody welcome you like that with open arms. And since that time, became good friends, and he's a genuine, sincere person, and she wanted to be involved in the advocacy work that I'm doing, and so that's why she made the video.
It was terrific to see. And you know, when someone like Amy Schumer decides to adopt a cause like yours, or even more positive, clemency in general, the whole need to expand clemency as a tool for bringing people home, that really resonates with people. When we played it, I was noticing how some of the younger people in the audience, you know, old geezers like me are not as attuned to Amy Schumer as others, but the young people in the audience, they were like, wow, that's Amy Schumer saying, bring Greg Mingo home. That was pretty great. You know, you had another scare though. At the time you were trying to get out, COVID broke out. You were behind bars. How did you handle that behind bars?
COVID was a big mess. Inside they locked everything down, so you was confined to the cell. So you didn't go to a mess hall. You didn't go anywhere. They fed you and yourself, and you just stayed in there. Now, a large part, a number of people probably developed COVID, but they didn't want to report that they were sick. Because if they reported they were sick, they would snap, take you out of your cell, take you to a whole other different part of the prison, and throw you in a cell up there. You'd have no property. You wouldn't have access to anything. And so nobody wanted to have to go through that. So a lot of times people just stayed in their cell and dealt with their sickness on their own because they knew if they reported being sick and tested positive for COVID, what awaited them.
Now they're essentially getting thrown in the hole for being sick.
Essentially, yeah.
Were there masks available after a while?
Donated masks. Not sure exactly where they came from, but eventually they issued out masks, cloth masks, and we were required to wear them.
Mm-hmm.
So you came out to sell, you had to wear your mask. And it's funny because we, as prisoners, we're inside, so we don't get to go any outside
right.
to bring anything in. But it's amazing because a lot of the staff refused to wear their mask.
Is that right?
And would only put it on if their supervisor came around. Then they might throw it on for a second or two till they left. And so that's how COVID got inside.
And that was the real threat.
Anybody inside.
Was that the officers and the employees are bringing it in with them, right?
And that's how it got inside. So, you know, a couple of people I know of passed away, but it was passed off that they died from something else. I had a friend of mine was in the hospital for a month and a half from COVID. And he says the only thing that saved him is that blood plasma treatment. You know, people who had contracted COVID and had recovered, and they would utilize their blood to treat other patients. But it was you know, it was kind of bad. So you just was stuck in the cell. You was a caged bird, and you were singing.
Had you already filed your clemency application by that time?
Yes. Initially, I had filed for clemency initially back in 2009. It was turned down.
Uh-huh.
In 2016, somebody else suggested I apply again. So I did. Then in 2017, the facility came to me and asked me, would I allow them to submit a clemency application on my behalf? So I said, okay. And then 18, 19, 20, and, you know, we just kept playing the waiting game.
Well, let me just back up there for a second. You said, when you say the facility came to you, who came to you and suggested that you reapply?
Well, I had already applied in 2016, but then the facility came to me. One of the senior counselors came to me and said they had instructions from Albany to find one person in the prison who they could submit for whose name they could submit for clemency. And out of the eligible people, they decided that I should be that person. At that time, I told them I didn't. They could do it, but I didn't have any faith in it. Because so few people receive clemency.
Right.
So they also told me I shouldn't feel that way. And when I said, why not? They said, well, Judith Clark got clemency. And Judith was also on the panel. So when I thought about it, I said, wow, maybe they have a point. You know. So I told them, go ahead and put it in. But, you know, as the years passed and the years passed and another year passed, nothing happened.
Was anybody getting clemency? Where were you at this point? This Great Meadow or Greenhaven?
I was in Great Meadows.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, right before that, in 2016, they had a list. They were going around the prison and they had specific names. They would go interview people and they were told that their name came up to submit to the governor's office for clemency. And to this day, nobody has heard anything back from them.
Yeah.
And it wasn't for the efforts of everybody and the push and bringing the attention, to change.org petition and the media petition. Without my niece's friends and amazing people that they are coming forward and working hard every week, having weekly meetings and pushing this push, I'd probably still be inside.
You would indeed. You would indeed.
With Steve Zeidman, who you know is amazing, And, you know, because nobody in New York really does clemency. Steve Zeidman is the only person I know of that done, that has done clemency. He's gotten 15 people out on clemency. He's helped over 50 people come home through clemency, resentencing. And he works tirelessly. And he works with very little. He utilizes students that, you know, come to him every year for him to educate. And he just does amazing work.
He does. He does indeed. We're talking about Steve Zeidman, who is the co-director of the Defenders Clinic at the City University of New York School of Law, and along with Ansha Bassar and his colleagues and his many students who each of them pick up clients like yourself and try to put together their applications. There are not a whole lot of clemencies given out, but of those that have been given out, as you said, they brought home 15 people.
Yeah, and those same 15 people that was brought home, we just created a clemency collective. So collectively, everybody in the collective received clemency, and we advocate for the governor to exercise our unchallenged power to grant more clemencies moving forward. Clemency doesn't have to be relegated to a one time a year around Christmas. You know, you have everybody's hopes and anticipations up, and then they only grant a couple of clemencies, and then the families and the children are really let down,
right?
Because now what happens to them?
Right.
The governor can grant clemencies around year round, every month if they want to. It's unchallengeable. And hopefully, you know, she'll keep a commitment that she's going to grant rolling clemencies.
Folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show is called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but I'm more importantly talking to Greg Mingo, who came home last year after 40 years in New York State prisons for a crime he did not commit, thanks to one of the rare and, as he says, unchallenged clemencies that have been handed out by New York governors. Your clemency group, the Clemency Collective, as you called it, you had a meeting at the governor's office not long ago, right, where you actually sat down with some of the people who decide this stuff or who advise her on it.
Right. We had a meeting in September with the person who's in charge of clemency now specifically, and the staff, maybe about 10 staffers. And we went and we had a meeting with them down in the governor's office. And prior to that, I had another meeting in the governor's office with a smaller group of people in July. Because I also, in addition to clemency, worked with the RAP organization, which is releasing aging people in prison.
Right.
And we advocate on prisoners' behalf. And we do a lot of advocacy work in Albany, talking to legislators, trying to get two bills passed, Elder Bill and Family Timely Parole Bill. And RAP has also taken on a clemency campaign.
Right.
And so we had a meeting in regards to that. That was in July. And then we had a second meeting with the Clemency Collective.
Were they listening to you? Did you feel like you were being respectfully received as you sat with the governor's people?
Yeah. I think the meeting went great. I think it was well received. We offered some suggestions. We requested some ask, and we look forward to future meetings.
Right.
I think it was successful.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we're getting ready to request another meeting with the governor's office, and we'd like to have a personal meeting with the governor herself.
Have you asked for that?
Excuse me?
Have you asked for a personal meeting with Governor Hochul?
Oh, we're about to. We were just waiting until after the election. Everything kind of died down, and we was going to ask for a personal meeting with Hochul and her clemency staff and go over the suggestion that we made. For instance, we requested that a pilot program be implemented where the governor grants clemencies at each maximum security prison throughout the state over the course of the year.
Hmm.
But we're talking about people who have earned an opportunity to have a second chance.
Absolutely.
So we advocate for those who have earned the right and that to have their life back. We understand the magnitude that they may have taken a life or, you know, the impact. And God, unless it's happened to you, you can only imagine the impact of losing a loved one, especially the violence. But these are people who have accepted responsibility, accepted remorse, and established an incredible, extraordinary record of change. And those are the people that we're trying to get home. You know, these people who have bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, men and women.
How many people like this do you think are currently locked up still in New York's prisons, the people you just described?
I described hundreds of them. Yeah, I'd say a good few hundred of them that are still inside.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke about my friend who passed away a week before I was released. Came in when he was 16. Last year, before he passed away, had been inside for 45 years.
Wow.
And, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around, you know, those kind of numbers. I was incarcerated for 40. So imagine what he must have had felt and experienced and how he'd been traumatized by 45 years.
It's hard to understand.
As time goes on, you begin to realize your own mortality.
Right.
You know, and inside it's like, you ever see those old black and white zombie movies?
Uh-huh.
And you see how in a zombie movie, maybe somebody shoots the zombie, and the zombie keeps coming.
Right.
It's like you don't have any fear. It's like if somebody shot you, there wouldn't be any pain. You know, you become numb to everything around you. But the truth is that you're desperate to latch on to, I guess, any kind of sensation to be able to take one clear, deep breath, kind of bring you back to life.
Did it feel sometimes like you were in a zombie movie, Greg Mingo?
Oh, yeah, I felt like that. I felt like as if, you know, I was dead at times, you know, that, you know, it's almost as if sometimes you lose your ability to feel. Like, you know, prison is very corrosive, and what it doesn't corrode, it swallows up. Fortunately, it didn't swallow me up.
It certainly did not
swallow me up.
You're an eloquent man, Greg Mingo. Let me ask you this. You said that you spent part of today, or at least you were planning on talking to high school students. You're sort of sharing the gospel now, aren't you? You're out there talking to people. How did that go with the kids?
I thought it went well. I went spoke to three classes over here in Ossining High School. I went to Bronx High School and spoke up there. I've spoken at Bard College. I spoke at the Innocence Conference. And a lot of times, you know, if they call on me and they ask me would I speak at a particular place or engagement, I usually go and do it because it has its benefits. I don't want somebody to have to experience what I experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And it can happen to anybody. And we go through life with blinders on, thinking, you know, nothing's going to happen to us. In the blink of an eye, one bad choice, one bad wrong turn, you could turn left instead of right, and your life changes forever.
Well, that's certainly, that's certainly what befell you, Greg Mingo. In the blink of an eye, you were gone. You know, one of your colleagues, part of the Clemency Collective, who was there the other night, Andre Jenkins, he told me that when he went away, he felt like it was the Flintstones, and now that he's came out, he feels like it's the Jetsons. How are you dealing with the world you've re-encountered now?
Yeah, well, that's a term that I used a lot.
Maybe he got it from you. Okay. I thought it was a good line.
I felt like Fred Flintstone going to visit George Jetson, because there's so much has changed in four decades. So much has changed. Cell phones didn't exist back then. You know, and just cultures, lifestyles, everything's changed. Nothing remains the same. And I don't have a problem with that because it's about, you know, things advance and things are always going to change and improve and get better, so to speak. But, yeah, it can be an eye-opener.
I'll bet it has been. What are your plans in the last minute that we got here? What are you looking to do?
I'm looking to continue to be an agent of hope for those that I left behind, kind of like this, in the same way that so many people were agents of hope for me. And so I didn't the best day in prison is the last one, but it's followed by a question, what do you do with the rest of your life? And I think seeing my friend die the week before I came home just answered that question for me.
Right.
So I decided to, you know, devote the rest of what time that I have towards helping others.
All right. A good man, Greg Mingo, 40 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Greg, thank you so much for taking all this time this evening to tell us your story and for sharing your position. It's really great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you again, Tom.
Okay, thanks so much. Thanks, Reggie Johnson. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis take us on out with Stolen Moments. Take care, everyone.
All right, bye.
WBI LSB Outreach and Fundraising Task Force meets in December on the 5th and the 19th. Each session begins with Meet the Producers, which will give listeners and staff an opportunity to directly converse about a particular program. On December the 5th, it's King Downing of Good Morning Nueva York. By phone, use Zoom number 646-558-8656. Our meeting ID is 922-457-2995 or WBAILSB995. The passcode is like our frequency, 995-995-99. Again, that's Monday, 7 p.m., December 5th. More information in the meeting section of WBAI.org.
Las cosas pasan rápido en la calle. Su velocidad le puede parecer lenta al manejar, pero si atropella a alguien, es espantosamente rápida. Conductores, estén pendientes de los peatones y ciclistas, y al doblar, reduzcan la velocidad a 5 millas por hora. El exceso de velocidad arruina vidas. Reduzca la velocidad. Un mensaje de la iniciativa Vision Zero de la ciudad de Nueva York.
Hi, New York. It's Dr. Vossen, the city's doctor. The holidays are my favorite time of year for gathering with our friends and loved ones. So with COVID-19, the flu, and RSV spreading, here are 5 health tips from me to you so you can enjoy the holidays safely. 1. Get the new COVID-19 booster. Everyone over 5, and especially those over 65, or who have a chronic health condition, should get the new booster right away. It protects against the variants of COVID-19 making people sick today. 2. Get your annual flu shot. You can safely get your flu and COVID-19 shots at the same time. 3. Wear a mask in crowds. Masks slow the spread of airborne illness. It's not an all-the-time thing, but for when you're around a lot of people indoors. 4. Stay home if you're sick and get tested for COVID-19. Talk to your provider or call 212-COVID-19 for Paxlovid or other treatment options. And 5. And as always, keep those hands clean. Spread cheer, not COVID or the flu, New Yorkers. After all we've been through, we all deserve a healthy and peaceful holiday.
Hi, it's Janine from Brooklyn. I have no complaints on WBAI. I'm very happy with everything.
My name is Anthony. Is it possible to create an app? Would that help build up the base if someone could just put an app on their phone, click on it, and get to BAI, like, and get to other radio stations?
This is Rose from Flemington, New Jersey. There are a lot of young people. Is there any way we can provide them with some college credit for volunteering? And it doesn't have to be on Atlantic Avenue. They can get together and do it remotely. Am I making any sense?
If you'd like to add your thoughts to the ongoing conversation regarding the work of the WBAI Local Station Board, then tune in Tuesday, December 6th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the second report of 2022 from the WBAI Local Station Board. This month, you'll be introduced to various members of the board. They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and ask you for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. Please keep in mind, this is your chance to interact with the board members on the show, so don't let this opportunity pass you by. Again, that's Tuesday, December 6th, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the second report of 2022 from the WBAI Local Station Board. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.